Good evening and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM in San Francisco. Standing in for the vacationing Jeff Hayden, I'm Robert Wyman. Well, it's the holiday season. It's come pretty quickly, maybe too quickly for some, along with the end of the year. And we want to present tonight some year-end tax tips for tax returns for 2024. How much has changed over the last year? How to respond to changes in my investment portfolio, recent gains in the crypto world, something I don't understand, but I'm sure our guests do. What do I need to be doing between now and year's end? And for that matter, if I have a corporation, what do the managers and executives want to be doing between now and year's end, and what areas should we be focusing on? As always, we're eager to hear what's on your mind and answer your questions. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134. If you're in the Bay Area, if you're outside the local dialing area, you can call 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. You can call us with any questions regarding taxation. You're not limited to the point where we may be in our conversation. Now, bear in mind that our guests cannot provide you precise legal or tax advice without having all the facts relating to your case. However, we're happy to pass along the legal principles to assist you in your decision-making. And while their legal guidance mightn't be the positions of their respective employers and clients, they're here to help. So I'm going to get the phone number one more time, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And outside the local dialing area, 866-798-8255. So let me introduce our guests. We have two this evening. Frank Adam of Pacifica, who's been a supporter of Your Legal Rights back in our Call a Lawyer Night days and is a guest on the show for many, many years. He is a real estate broker and certified public accountant. Also with us tonight is Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law, APC in San Jose. She has 21 years now of experience focused extensively on tax controversy and litigation. She possesses significant experience in advising and advocating for individuals, small businesses, corporate clients on numerous tax issues before federal and state taxing agencies. Cindy has also represented clients before the U.S. Tax Court, U.S. District Court, U.S. Bankruptcy Court, and various California courts. So, Cindy and Frank, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Rob. Happy to be here.
Good evening, Rob.
Hey, Frank. Hi, Cindy. So, where to get started? The big question is there anything I need to be doing between now and the end of the year to get ready for April?
Gather your information. Start now. The more information that taxpayers can provide to their preparer, and the cleaner that information is, the easier and it will be to prepare the tax and likely less expensive.
Also, we got, 13 days before the year closes. If you have a business and you want to reduce some of that profit, reducing your taxable income, buy some office expenses. It's not too late. You can still use the next 13 days to your benefit. And then also, when you're gathering, I have some clients, when they're getting all their paperwork together, they forget that there's some investment accounts, financial accounts, where their documents aren't sent to them in the mail. They're only accessed through the online application. So make sure to think about all of your investment accounts, financial accounts, and go online and download those records. Typically, those are available by the end of January.
And I take it this is a conversation that people should be having with their accountant or their tax attorney right now as to how they stand for the year. In other words, Cindy, you mentioned, and Frank, maybe this is a good time to prepay some rent this year, or maybe it's better to hold off those decisions and those payments until next year. I never know the answer to that, so I personally call my accountants and say, what should we do?
I actually am making certain purchases that I could hold off until next year now, knowing that it's going to reduce my net business income. So I'm doing that, and it's something that I always do right before the year end.
The only thing that I would add to that is if a person who owns a business has not had a great year in terms of revenue, then it may be better to hold off on capital expenditures or ordinary and necessary business expenses, because they may not get the best tax benefit, depending if they're, especially if they're in a lower bracket. If they anticipate the next year being much better in terms of revenue, and they're going to be in a higher bracket next year, then at that point they should defer any capital expenditure or expense that they might otherwise take to between now and the end of the year. So they have to keep track of their income and their bottom line before the end of the year. They should do that periodically through the year. I'm finding with more and more, especially new clients, they do not track their income either monthly or quarterly, and at the end of the year they get surprised. So if you don't have if you're not keeping a complete set of books, an accurate set of books, that's something to look into. And if your bookkeeper is not assisting you in that matter, it might be time to look for a new bookkeeper.
I can't agree more. I remember as a sole practitioner, you know, I'd be waiting for checks to come in to make sure I could make my payroll, and anxiously awaiting the checks. And then the 1099s would start coming in January, and I think, oh, good grief, I did better than I thought. I'm going to have a big tax bill. So probably I should have been looking at those things throughout the year to plan ahead. Like, this is going to be this is a slow year. So yeah, I'm going to have a low tax bill. I don't need to go out and spend money to lower my overall profits for the year.
Correct. And if you have an entity, an LLC or an S corporation, the rules are quite a bit different. And, taking too much money out of the entity, especially an S corporation, that can result in some capital gains taxes. So it's very, very important that people who have businesses keep a regular set of books. I'm sorry if that's the CPA in me talking, but that's important. And too many businesses today run their business by a seat of the pants approach, and they don't look at these things until the last month or couple months of the year. And by that time, it's too late.
Well, I'll just say that I'm really lucky. I have a great CPA, and I think that's been so invaluable. And I shopped around and I switched until I found someone that I could comfortably work with. And I don't have to contact them throughout the year. They contact me and that's let great. Me know how things are going and what I need to be doing. Luckily, I've never had to hire someone like Cindy, except because my taxes have always been on time and accurate. I haven't had any problems with the IRS. You know, tax filing, you know, I think we all know it's April 15, and that's when we have to file our taxes. But frequently people will file extensions. And what does that mean, just to file an extension? What's going on there, as opposed to actually filing the tax return in April?
You can file the extension for 6 months. On the federal level, you have to file an extension either on paper or electronically, and that gives you 6 months to file the return. It does not give you six extra months to pay the taxes. So you have to estimate accurately what the tax liability is, make sure that it's paid, and file the extension. In California, if you want an extension, you don't need to paper file as long as you've made enough estimated tax payments to cover the total tax liability.
And one reason, 1 year I was advised to file an extension is that my accountant said you could put some more money into your retirement plan and you can continue to contribute after April. And I don't understand how this stuff works. I just do what they tell me to do. So the amount that I would owe in October might be different than the amount that I think I owe in April.
Cindy, you want to take it or you want me to?
You can take that one.
Okay. If you have certain types of retirement plans, if it's a KEO plan or what's called a SEP IRA, you may make the You may make the deduction on the return and contribute to that plan as late as the extended due date, which is roughly October 15th of the following year, and it still counts toward the contribution for the previous year. However, if it's just a regular conventional IRA, you don't get that privilege or that opportunity. You have to make that contribution by April 15th. So it depends on the type of plan you have. The reason the IRS, or I'm guessing that the reason that you're allowed the extra 6 months to make the contribution is a cash flow issue. People have made certain profits. They may need additional time to get enough cash to contribute to the retirement plan. So check with your tax preparer or accountant, attorney, what have you, and make sure that your plan qualifies for that deferred contribution in as late as October.
And what is the difference between a SEP IRA and just a regular IRA that any worker might have?
A regular IRA has fairly low limits, $7,000 to $8,000 as to how much you can contribute per year. And there are some income restrictions as well. A SEP IRA is a simplified employee pension, and it's generally set up for self-employed people or people with smaller entities. But they can set up more elaborate plans as well. The more elaborate plans will require the assistance of someone who will help you administer the plan. And at certain points, the more elaborate plans require their own tax return. A SEP IRA, Simplified Employee Pension IRA, does not require that elaborate structure. It's a plan, in my opinion, designed for the self-employed, right? Hence the SEP, Self-Employed Simplified Employee Pension.
So that would apply to someone who just has a business of their own and maybe no employees or one employee. But I guess would that also apply to the tech worker who's making 1099 money? They're not getting a paycheck. No taxes are being withheld from the money that they receive. Would a SEP IRA be good for them?
Yes, it can work for once when you use the term 1099 person, that person is in business for himself, whether they know it or not. Only people that get W-2s, a wage and tax summary, are the wage and tax statement, are considered employees. People who are getting 1099s, even if they haven't established a formal business, they're going to have to file the same type of return, same type of schedules on their individual returns, namely Schedule C, Schedule SE, and if they've purchased equipment, the depreciation schedule, which is 4562, I believe.
And the contribution limits for a SEP IRA can be as high as $67,000 or 25% of your net income.
It's 25%, right, yeah. Yes.
So that self-employed person can lower their tax bill substantially and start building up a nice retirement nest egg by using the SEP IRA.
Yes, and just keep in mind that the money that's put into those retirement plans is exempt from income tax. It is not exempt from Social Security or Medicare tax. You're still going to pay that tax on all of the net income.
Okay. So if I have a really good accountant and I get my taxes in on time and I pay them on time, I might not be calling Cindy. But if I'm one of those people that doesn't open the mail and just chooses to ignore and deny and delay, Cindy, what happens if I just don't file in April?
Well, what could happen is, and it does take some time for the IRS and the state of California to catch up to a taxpayer. But normally what happens if you don't file and there's income information reported to the IRS and the state, and even in some cases, if there's no income information, I can give you an example, the state and the IRS could file a return for a taxpayer and then just make an assessment. And so if you are self-employed, for example, who gets 1099s, the IRS and the state will see the 1099 income. But when they make the assessment of tax, they're not going to account for business expenses that you may incur to generate that income. And so typically the assessment is going to be much higher than if you were to have filed your return. And then in cases where there's no 1099s issued, but let's say, for example, you're a licensed individual, like I'm a licensed attorney or a licensed real estate agent. The state of California knows that you have a license. And so they think, okay, you must be generating some income. Maybe it's not reported to us. They can estimate it just based on you having a license. And so they make that assessment. You have opportunities to protest that, appeal that. But if you don't do anything, at some point, that will become a legal tax liability that the taxing agencies can collect on. So, but it's not too late. Even if they make the assessment, the IRS or the state, you can replace that assessment with a tax return, which can get audited, but you still have the right to file a tax return to correct that assessment.
So at some point, like, gee, I didn't file in April. I've just been ignoring the letters from the franchise tax board, and I've been ignoring the letters from the IRS. I can go file a tax return, but I assume that there might be some sort of penalties or something involved there.
Yes, there's a late filing penalty, which is maxes out at 25%. So it's 5% a month. So that maxes out at 6 months. At 6 months. Five months. But there's also a late payment penalty that Frank had mentioned earlier. So on the assessed tax, they're charging a late payment penalty, which is also 25%. That's the max, but it assesses at 0.5% every month. So that takes longer to max out. One thing to keep in mind is that, let's say the state or the IRS makes an assessment and they overassess and you choose not to do anything about it. The state and the IRS, they have the ability to collect on that tax through garnishments or bank levies. And what can end up happening, and I've seen this in some cases, is that the government can overcollect. And there's a statute of limitations on how long you can have to get that refund back. And so the Franchise Tax Board has a statute of limitations of 4 years from the time the return was supposed to be filed, or 1 year from the time of payment, whichever is later. The IRS has a 3-year statute, or 2 years from the time of payment, whichever is later. And I have seen, I think the most egregious case I've seen was my client had a liability from 2008. His paycheck was garnished by the Franchise Tax Board 25% every month. And he hired someone who didn't really know how to fix it. So a decade goes by. And so then he comes to me and he didn't owe a single dollar. And he ended up paying over $200,000 in tax that he didn't owe. And at most, he was only going to be eligible to get back a year's worth of payments upon filing the, we did an audit reconsideration. So that's like a horror story that you'd want to avoid. So you don't be late in filing your return if the government owes you money.
And I guess a lesson to take away from that is open those letters from the IRS, open those letters from the Franchise Tax
Board.
Yes,
and if you don't want to open them, you can hire a tax attorney. The tax attorney can open them for you.
Let them figure it out and tell you the good or the bad news.
Right, that's right.
Well, the interesting thing is, I said, when I first opened my business, I was trying to do a lot of the taxes myself, and I wasn't doing them correctly. And I got a call. I got the letter. I was scared to death. And I got on the phone with the person from the IRS, and they were so helpful. They said, we understand you're a new business. We're going to get you through this. We're going to sort this out for you. And that's when I also hired the new accountant. And I found them to be very friendly and very helpful. You know, they didn't want to punish me. They wanted my business to succeed. And they wanted to help me straighten out, you know, what I was doing wrong with my filings. So
I would agree with that sentiment. For the most part, I think the taxing agencies, they don't want to overcollect. They just want to collect the correct amount. And for the most part, my experience has been positive. You know, they're there to help you, and they're there to help your client and the taxpayers hopefully resolve the issue, right? The ones that are more challenging are the systemic issues where you're not just dealing with 1 year, you might be dealing with 5 years or 6 years. And this isn't the first time where someone's calling it. This might be the fifth call and nothing's changed. And so those are more challenging cases, but it's definitely something that can be fixed. So, you know, I've had a case and there's always a resolution. I don't think I've encountered a situation where there wasn't a way to fix it. So yes, the IRS is there to help. The state is there to help as well. And I think we have a question that was asked about EV tax credits. And so the question is, will I be able to take a deduction for my Prius Prime hybrid that I purchased last year? I heard that the Republicans may eliminate that deduction. Frank, do you want to comment on that one?
Well, the politics of it aside, certain vehicles are eligible for a credit, certain vehicles are not. If the maximum number of vehicles throughout the nation have been sold, the credit probably has expired. Certain vehicles still qualify for the credit. Those credits, from my experience, have been reviewed and renewed or not reviewed multiple times. None of those things are set in stone. You're going to have to check, and before you buy the vehicle, make sure that that vehicle is still eligible for the credit. And you're going to have to do that by either looking at the relevant websites, the Internal Revenue Service or Franchise Tax Board, or consult with your tax preparer and let them do that research for you. But not every vehicle is eligible for a credit.
Because there's so many of those sorts of credits out there, and I don't know whether they're still in effect or not in effect. I remember at one point there was a credit if you put in a high-efficiency furnace. There were credits if you did solar. And I didn't even know where to go to find out, well, if I buy this furnace, am I going to get a credit or not? Or is the solar credit still there? I guess an accountant would be a person that would hopefully know the answer to that.
Yes, you should consult with a tax accountant or someone familiar enough with the code and your tax situation to give you the proper advice. And it's not, I am not a fan of letting the tax code wag the business dog. You don't do things just because you're going to get a tax credit. Make sure that what you're buying or installing or what have you makes financial sense. Certain things you get a tax credit for, but there are other financial obligations with the purchase of that piece of equipment or solar energy or whatever it is, and you get to pay that money. You may save a little bit in tax, but overall, you may pay more for everything than you anticipated.
It's funny, you remind me of years ago, I shared office space with an attorney who said, Rob, you should lease a car. There's better tax advantages if you lease a car. You can write it off. I said, but my car's paid for. I'm not paying anything right now. Why should I go out and incur a lease just so I could get a tax break?
Yeah, exactly. If you need a car, that's one thing. But if you need a piece of equipment, that's one thing. And that without that piece of equipment, you can't function in a business or even in your home. Fine. I understand the expenditure. But to spend just for the sake of the tax break doesn't make sense to me unless you've done some rather complex planning. And that involves throwing around a lot of numbers and analyzing those numbers. And that's not a popular subject for people.
Yeah, because I guess if you're looking at something like solar that's quite expensive, it may turn out that you qualify for the tax credit, but your taxes are so low that year, it's really not much of a value.
Yeah, it's a good example.
Okay.
And what is the cost of the solar before and after the credit? What is the cost of how long is that solar heating system or solar electricity system going to last? I always recommend that people do what's called a break-even analysis. And again, that's the CPA in me talking as opposed to the attorney, but it's important to do that.
So we're starting a new year. We've got a new administration in Washington. We're going to have a new Congress. And of course, everybody's speculating about, will we have tariffs? Is the tax credit for electric cars going to be taken away? Or are we going to keep it? Have the two of you, I doubt either one of you has a crystal ball, but maybe you have some thoughts about what we might be seeing in the future.
It's a wait and see. Mr. Trump has promised to simplify the code. I hope he does. It's a very complex code. Sometimes even simple questions can take a long time to answer. So I hope he does simplify the code. What results from that in terms of tax rates, credits, deductions is wait and see. It's silly to speculate on that.
All right. And I'm going to take a moment here just to give out our phone number again. Here in the San Francisco area, it's 415-841-4134 or the toll-free number 866-798-8255. So probably not a good time to be making major business changes in anticipation of what might be happening in Washington next year.
Right. It's a wait and see. There are certain provisions of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that are set to expire in 2026. Trump has said that his plan is to extend or make permanent some of these provisions that will expire, but we don't know what will happen. One of the provisions is one of the biggest changes are the SALT, the state and local tax deduction. You know, it's limited to 10,000. So should you buy that big house? Well, I don't know. If those limitations are extended, then buying a big house with a huge property tax bill, it may not benefit you tax wise. So I think Frank is right. It's a wait and see what happens the next coming year or the next couple of years.
And we had another question come in, and that is probably directed to Frank's comment. By simplifying the tax code, does that mean the possibility of a flat tax? We've been hearing about flat taxes for years. Does anyone think that's ever going to happen?
Again, there's no way to tell how simple the tax code will become. I think it's fair to say that each time an administration promises to simplify the code, it gets more complicated. So a real simplification of the code will result in drastic changes. Whether that happens this time around, we don't know. President-elect Trump is now his second time in office, which tells me that he's going to have a lot more savvy as to how Congress, both the House and the Senate, work their dynamics, and maybe that gives him an advantage. But again, that's all speculation. And I also want to speak to the SALT tax issue. Many people have complained about the lack of the state and local tax deduction, but what is often left out of that discussion is that the state and local tax deduction was known as a tax preference item for the purposes of the alternative minimum tax. So taking the deduction for state and local taxes was sometimes offset by the additional tax a person would pay on the alternative minimum tax. And in the worst case, it's a dollar for dollar offset. So depending on what he does with, or what the new administration does with the alternative minimum tax, as he did the last time, he reduced it dramatically, basically constructively almost removed it, not quite. If that comes back, then the SALT tax deduction may not be as great a benefit as people think it is.
And
it's a hot potato as well.
Again, to sort of clarify, back in the day, I could write off in my federal taxes what I paid for property tax, what I paid for state income tax. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, there was no limit on that. And now it's $10,000, and even, I don't know, sales tax. But now the limit for all of them is just $10,000.
That's correct. For the moment, yeah. It's $10,000.
Okay.
And for the sales tax, it's sales tax versus state income tax. So you have to pick one method or the other.
Oh, okay. So you don't get to, well, again, with the $10,000 limit and living in a high tax state like California. That's probably not an issue for most people. They might hit that $10,000 limit just on their state income tax without even taking into consideration property tax, et cetera.
That's right.
Well, we are just about at the halfway point of the program already, and so I'm going to turn it over to Joanne Marr for a couple of announcements, and we will be right back.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, The Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information. And now back to your legal rights.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. I'm going to give out the phone number one more time. Again, the local number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or our toll-free number, 866-798-8255. I'm speaking tonight with Frank Adam and Cindy Ho. Frank is a CPA and real estate broker. Cindy Ho is a tax attorney. And we're discussing end-of-the-year tax issues and just tax issues in general. So I was thinking about something, you know, the way the world has changed and politics has changed. I don't remember how many years ago someone had to drop out of some sort of race because they didn't pay their nanny, the nanny tax. And that back at simpler times, not paying the nanny properly disqualified one from public office. But how does one handle that if you have a housekeeper come in or an au pair watching the kids to do it legally? How is that done?
You could. So if you have someone coming into the house on a consistent basis and working hourly, you can treat them as a household employee. And there's a schedule on the tax return for that purpose. And then there's services actually. And it's through, and I only know this because I have kids, through Care.com, there are companies that offer payroll services for your household employees. They will generate the paycheck. They will take out the tax withholdings. They'll do all the reporting requirements. But there's a form on your income tax returns for household employees. In terms of the housekeeper, if you hire someone to come in once a month to come in and clean your house, they technically, I would argue that they're not your household employee because they're not coming in on a consistent basis. But if you are paying them more than $600 and this person is operating their business as a sole proprietorship or an LLC, not through a corporation, you're required to issue that person a 1099 for anything. So if you're paying them more than $600, and so there you should be getting their social security number, their name, and you can have them fill out what's called a W-9. So that's the proper way to do it. Frank, would you agree?
Yeah, and they should also know that it's a 1099 NEC, non-employee compensation, and that is now due by January 31st of the following year. Used to be, I think it was, used to be March, and now it's January. So you have to get it in on time, and the failure to file, I believe, is still a $50 penalty per 1099. And those forms are easily completed. There are inexpensive programs you can buy from any office supply store that will help you complete the 1099. They can even be electronically filed.
And I'll make a pitch for those companies too, because I always have to sort of work in my field, which is workers' compensation, and the hazards of having someone come in your house and potentially be injured. And as Cindy was mentioning, there are companies out there that will take care of all that for you. If you need someone to come in and do a project or come in on a, you know, once a month to clean, they will make sure the taxes are paid. They will make sure all the forms are filed properly, and they'll carry workers' compensation coverage in case that person is injured while working in your home. Otherwise, they can come after the homeowner as an individual with a lawsuit, as opposed to simply workers' compensation benefits. So there's an advantage to looking into those companies, I think, for protection.
Yeah, if they're working for an entity and that entity is supplying you with the service, and they are the employee of the entity, not you, but you'll pay for all of that.
Right, it costs more money.
Yeah, but it may be worth it depending on what they do.
So earlier on, Cindy, we were talking about, you know, if someone fails to file their taxes, there's going to be some fines or penalties that are going to be assessed. But there's a little joke about, you know, they couldn't get Al Capone on his illegal businesses, but they got him on his taxes. So, I mean, what does one have to do to actually go to prison over tax issues?
Well,
I mean, how bad does it have to be?
I think that, and I don't have experience working for the government, but from what I've been told and also cases that I've worked on, there's a number of things that are looked at. And most criminal cases potentially start as civil audits. And so you could have a situation where someone gets examined and there's things that are going to be looked at. Is all the income captured on the tax return? Are all the expenses accurate or were they inflated? Are these negligent mistakes, innocent mistakes, or are these intentional mistakes? So, and there's a number of things that are looked, you know, there's badges of fraud that they look at. And so they look at, are there messy books and records? The amount that is underreported in terms of income or overstated in expenses really significant? And is it a reoccurring problem? They look to see whether or not this is a cash, heavy cash intensive business, and there's no internal controls and no records to account for the cash. And they look for certain behaviors from the taxpayer to see, you know, there are deceptive behaviors where, and someone can be, you know, willfully blind. They don't want to have good books and records for the purpose of that. So there are certain things like that that the government looks at. And then once there's evidence that there may be some intentionality with respect to how the returns are being prepared and how the business is being operated, then what they can do is they can make a referral to the Internal Revenue Service Criminal Investigation Department. And that's when the civil audit is supposed to be suspended. You can't have a civil audit and a criminal case ongoing at the same time because someone that's under criminal investigation has certain constitutional rights. And so typically you'll see the civil audit being paused, and then there are investigators that are assigned to the case, and they work up the case, and that could be talking to potential witnesses, that could be talking to the CPA, the preparer, could be in the form of summons and subpoenas of bank records. And so I've seen cases where my client is approached by a criminal investigator and they're the target, and the investigator's already gotten the bank records and gotten deposited items from various sources. So they already have a lot of information. And once all that information is gathered, and it can take some time, it can take years, then that those set of facts and the case is then presented to the Department of Justice to see if they're going to charge the individual. That's on the federal side. The state side, I've seen cases, I actually had a case where my client was charged for failing to file a tax return, intentionally failing to file a tax return. But there were some other crimes also charged as well. My client ended up getting the tax return related charges removed because he had hired me a year before the criminal case started. And typically someone that intentionally fails to file doesn't hire an attorney to help them file the tax return. So I could be used as a witness in that case. And so I looked up the law, sent it to the criminal defense attorney. I said, look, I would be the prime witness for the client. And those charges were actually removed. The other ones, some of the other ones stayed, but that's to give you an example. And the reason why they looked at that was because he had not filed for, I think, over 10 years. And the state had assessed a very significant amount. So it's a large amount involved and a decade's worth of return. So it has to be like so egregious enough, you know, very good facts for the government to want to prosecute.
Okay. So if I mess up, I might get fined, but I'm probably not going to go to Alcatraz.
No.
That's what you're telling me. So some questions that I get sometimes from my clients, for example, they get their workers' compensation benefits and they ask me, do I have to pay tax on this? And I say, well, no, but I'm not a tax attorney and I'm not an accountant. But my understanding is no, you don't pay a tax on those benefits. But what about things like state disability? If someone's injured and they're collecting state disability benefits or unemployment benefits, are those taxable? And is there a place on the tax form where you put in that information? How does that work?
Frank, I'll let you take this one since you prepare tax returns.
State disability payments are generally not going to be subject to tax.
And is there any, I guess my client's concern is that they're either the state or the feds might look and say, well, gee, where did this money come from? Is there a place on the return where you put in, hey, I got this money, but this is not taxable income? How do they let the state know that check they're getting is not taxable?
There should be. If something is going to be taxable, you're likely to get some form of 1099-G. A 1099-G means coming from the government, which will explain how much you received. So I don't think in my practice I've ever seen a 1099-G for disability. I've seen it for unemployment compensation, but I've not seen it for state disability.
I would agree. I don't think that's reported.
I've never seen it.
Right. But for example, if you have private disability insurance, that may be taxable depending upon who pays the premiums. So my understanding is if the employer pays the premiums for your disability insurance, then those disability payouts would be subject to taxation. However, correct me if I'm wrong, Frank, but if you are self-insuring the disability premiums, then I don't believe that it's taxable, those disability benefits.
And something that's near and dear to my heart. Oh, go ahead, Frank.
Correct. Yes. I agree with Cindy. Yes.
Okay. Something that I've been thinking about lately is I get closer and closer to the day where I'm going to be getting a Social Security check. I love to go on the Social Security website and see, well, this is my benefit if I take it at this age or that age. And all of a sudden I realize, oh, I think I'm going to have to pay tax on this. I was disappointed to learn that. How is Social Security, when someone's getting a Social Security check from the government, how is that taxed?
Most of Social Security is not taxable, but you may have other income besides Social Security, right? And so what could happen is, let's say your Social Security benefits are $25,000. Most of that's not going to be taxable, maybe a small portion, but then you'll have distributions from your 401k or your IRA, for example, which would be subject to taxation. The Social Security potentially could get you up to where your income's going to be taxed.
And I know people now, I think you have to take, as I understand it, Social Security at age 70. You can put it off till age 70, but at age 70, they start sending a Social Security check. And I know people that are still working after age 70. So when you say income, I guess then the IRS is going to look at income from the job, income from things like investments, and then also the Social Security money that's coming in. And at that point, I guess you could be subject to some taxes.
Right.
Okay.
And it's good, you know, to prepare prior to retirement. And I know people that they plan to retire at a certain age, they're going to get a pension. They have a certain amount in retirement. They budget and they'll see, okay, this is what I need to live. And, you know, obviously there's some accounting for inflation and increases of cost of living. And then you could see what you can project and work with your CPA and your accountant, what the tax obligation is going to be year after year after year. And so it's not a mystery. So it's important to do that type of planning before you retire. One, do you have enough to retire? And then two, if you do, what your taxes are going to look like, because you're going to have to factor that into your expenses. And so that's there's financial advisors that can help you with that and work alongside with your accountant.
And that takes me back to Frank, because I know there's different types of IRAs. There's the Roth IRA and then just the regular IRA. And as I understand it, when you the Roth IRA is contributed after tax. So when you take that money out, you're not paying tax on it. But with the IRA, as you make withdrawals in retirement, you that is income, Frank, and you're paying tax on it?
Right. The Roth IRA, the contribution you make to the Roth IRA, you're not going to get a tax deduction for at the in the year of the contribution. The Roth IRA grows tax-free, and when you withdraw from it, there are no taxes at all. With a regular IRA or other regular retirement plan, such as a SEP, a 401k, a KEO plan, when you make the deduction, you get the when you make the contribution, you get the deduction. When you take the money out after age 59 and a half or 59 and a half and after, you will be taxed on it. And when you reach approximately the age of 72, you must take money out of those retirement plans. And if you don't, the penalty is pretty stiff. It's 50%. So
as I understand it, yeah, if you take money out of a retirement account before age 59 and a half, you're going to be paying taxes on it and paying a penalty. When you're 60, you'll be paying taxes on it.
But no penalty.
Now, I'm over 60 and I'm still working, so I'm not taking any money out. But at a certain age, they're going to force me to take a certain amount of money out of my retirement accounts.
That's correct.
And if I don't need the money, if I planned well and maybe I don't need to take as much out, you know, what it's like, I don't need that much money this year. Why do I have to take this out? And if I take it out, now what happens to it?
Well, if you're required to take it out, it becomes taxable income. And if you don't need it, put it in the bank and let it earn some interest income, which also will become taxable.
Okay.
But once you're required to take it out, it's going to be taxable income. And it's the RMDs, depending on when you're born, I'm looking at that table as we speak here. It ranges between 70 and a half and 75. So if an employee is born after January 1, 1960, the applicable age is 75. And then there are a host of other age requirements for the required minimum or age limits for the required minimum distribution. So depending on when you were born, the RMD is going to come into play at a different age.
I see. We just had another question come in, and I apologize to our listeners. I'll just be up front. We have a brand new phone system here, and people may be trying to call in, and Joanne may not be able to get the calls to us, but she is giving us the questions through the miracle of computers. And someone has asked, can you give IRA distributions to a charity so that they won't be taxed? So I'm assuming this person is over, like we said, they have to take their distributions. They don't want to pay a tax on it. Can they just give that money to a charity and avoid the tax? How does that work?
So the way it would work is that for their IRA, you would name a beneficiary. So they could name a charity as a beneficiary. And if that charity is recognized as a 501c3 tax exempt, then upon death, that IRA would go to the named beneficiary, the 501c3 charitable organization, and that IRA could be liquidated by the charity, not subject to taxes because they're tax exempt. And it would not be an obligation of the trust or the state to cash it out and pay taxes on it.
So let's just say I finally get the winning lottery numbers and I'm 73 and I don't really need that money in my IRA. When I have to make those distributions, I have to take the money out. Is there a way to sort of have that again sort of automatically go to a charity by making them the beneficiary ahead of time? Or can I just say, okay, I have to take $3,000 out of my IRA, but I'm just going to turn around and give it to the SPCA?
I don't think there's a mechanism to do it where you're living, where you can take out money from your IRA and give it to the, well, the way it would work is you take out money from your IRA, which is a taxable event for you.
Correct.
However, if you give it to, if you give that $3,000, or let's say $3,000 minus the taxes related, to the charity, you can take the deduction if you itemize, and I think there's a limitation, like you can deduct $500 if you don't itemize, but you can take that as an itemized deduction as a charitable contribution, which is a write-off, a personal deduction. But it's not going to be dollar for dollar in that scenario.
And are there limits on charitable donations these days? I remember it used to be that just whatever you donated to a charity just came right off the top of your taxes. Are there limits on how much people can give to charities?
Well, it's not a charitable contribution is not a what's called above the line deduction. It's part of the itemized deduction. So it's not quite as beneficial as you've described. So if you made charitable contributions, they're added to the other itemized deductions on Schedule A. And to the extent that those deductions exceed what's called the standard deduction, you benefit from it. If it doesn't, the standard deduction is a greater benefit, and that's what you should use.
Okay, that's right. And you can't take a charitable deduction if you've taken the standard deduction. And we have Anne Marie.
No, that's not what I mean.
Oh, okay. Restate that for me, Frank.
If your standard deduction is higher than your itemized deductions, take the standard deduction. If the itemized deductions are higher than the standard deduction, take that one. The charitable contributions you make are part of the itemized deduction.
I see. So that can raise your itemized deductions to where it becomes advantageous to go that route and take itemized as opposed to the standard.
Let's simple illustration. Let's assume for the purposes of this illustration that the standard deduction is $25,000. Okay. And you make charitable contributions of $25,100. Only your itemized deductions and if you have no other itemized deductions, your itemized deduction is higher, so you take the $25,100. However, you're only going to benefit substantively from a $100 difference.
I see.
You took the standard deduction, you take a $25,000 deduction. So you, whatever your tax rate is, you multiply that by 100 bucks, and that's your benefit.
I see. So, and I asked you a complicated question while Anne Marie has been patiently waiting on the line. So Anne Marie, are you with us?
Yeah, I just took my required minimum deduction from Fidelity Investments. And when I was transferring it, I think I transferred it to a high interest paying savings account. Somehow the taxes were taken out, but I was alerted to the amount of taxes. And so if you're taking it from your investment, which I say a solid investment company, the math will be done for you. I just did that last week. So anyway, FYI.
Oh, thank you, Anne Marie. And we also have Sean from Oakland with a call. Sean, are you on? What's your question?
Hi there. Actually, I had a comment regarding the last question you had just before the last question about what I think the caller had been asking about is something that's called a qualified charitable distribution, which is when you can take a distribution from an IRA or a retirement plan and direct it directly to a charity, as long as it's a qualified charity. And that would be considered part of your RMD, and it's not taxable. So then it has to be reported separately on your 1090, on your 1040. But that is a cleaner way to give to charity rather than paying the taxes and then taking the deduction afterwards. And I'm an investment advisor here in the Bay Area. We do that for clients all the time. So that might have been what they were thinking of.
All right, great. Well, thank you for the information, Sean. We appreciate it.
One point on that, I believe you have to be at least 70 and a half on the day of the transfer for the qualified charitable distribution.
And because
I
have a simple brain, I'm going to sort of restate this because I know, for example, when someone wants to transfer money from one IRA to another, the transfer has to go directly between the entities. If it comes to me first and then I put it into another IRA, there's going to be tax consequences. So it's like I can't get the money myself. I have to have entity A send it directly to entity B. Now, that may be what Sean was telling us.
Right.
At the end of the hour. That went quickly. We've got about a minute for each one of you. If you have any last-minute thoughts on anything we should be doing or if you just want to wish everyone a happy holiday, please do so. Cindy, any last-minute thoughts?
I'm thinking a lot about crypto these days just because I'm getting a lot of calls from people who have unfortunately been scammed out of their retirement accounts, their savings, because they're getting approached to invest in these fake crypto platforms. But with crypto, if you have cryptocurrency, you're investing in that and you're paying someone in crypto, selling crypto, swapping the crypto, gifting the crypto, these are things that you have to keep, make sure that you report on your tax return. You have to disclose if you have crypto. And some of the platforms are very good at offering tax records for you. Others are not. And so just make sure that you report that. Just one example is that, the Internal Revenue Service, they have a lot of information on these crypto transactions. And so at some point, if you're not reporting it, there's going to be potentially more audits involving crypto. And I definitely see that coming. So for all the crypto investors, just make sure you work with a really good accountant, CPA, and make sure you're tracking those transactions.
And we are
happy holidays, everyone.
Thanks. We are just about out of time. So Frank, I may have to cut you off from any last minute thoughts
and no saying
happy holidays to both of you. And thank you both for your support of this program over the years. I appreciate it. The listeners appreciate it. And it's been good to be here with you tonight. So you've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. And you can stream the program as well on your audio device. Tonight, our topic was yearly tax tips. And our guests have been Cindy Ho of Cindy Ho Law in San Jose and Frank Adam, who is a certified public accountant, attorney, and real estate broker in Pacifica. And again, thank you both for joining us. Be sure to join Your Legal Rights again next week, where, as always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. So I'd like to one last time thank our guests, Frank and Cindy. Our thanks to all of you in the audience for listening. At the controls, our thanks and happy holidays to Joanne Marr. And for Jeff Hayden, I'm Rob Wyman. Enjoy your holidays, have a safe new year, and good night, and remember to always zealously guard your legal rights.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.